Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Education Is podcast. As always, you can find us at home on the web at www.educationis.us. Our theme for today is Education Is About Motivation, and we've really enjoyed researching this topic. Today we're going to talk first about some of our biggest questions as teachers and educators and people who support education, how motivation matters to us, how motivation affects the classroom and our learners. Then we're going to talk about some of the big thinkers who are kind of writing and researching in the field today about motivation. And then we're going to wrap up by trying to nail down some practical tips for motivating your students. So my name is Nicole Forsyth, and I'm a librarian at Kirkwood Community College, joined today by my trusty co-host, Alan Paterka. Hello, Alan.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Nicole.
And we're also delighted to have with us today an associate professor of psychology here at Kirkwood Community College, Jennifer Brenham.
Hello. Thank you.
So, Jennifer, can you tell us real quick some of the classes that you teach?
I teach psychology and sociology.
Okay.
Developmental psychology is my favorite. I also teach intro to soc and intro to psych.
Fabulous. Well, we're pleased to have you here so that we can kind of jump right into talking about motivation.
Is having a favorite class kind of like having a favorite child?
We'll find out when I have my second.
Okay.
Only have one right now.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Well, to motivate us, I always like to bring things to our podcast. Apologies to our listeners that I can't share these with you. I really wanted to bring some carrots.
I have some carrots in my bag.
All right. for the old carrot and stick motivation, but today we have some candy and Starburst. So a little bit of extrinsic motivation for us as we think and talk today. So my first question Alan and I sort of came up with to ask ourselves is, should motivation matter to us as teachers? Will motivated students perform better in class than unmotivated students? Discuss.
I think that's a pretty easy question to answer. Right. Of course
I
they're going to.
I think so, too.
Yes, absolutely. The question is, how do we motivate them? Are they coming motivated at all?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we take them to that next level?
One question that I was sort of wondering and thinking about is, how do you know if students are motivated? For both Alan and
Jennifer.
It's
by the looks in their eyes, right? Some gleam in their eye, and I did kind of think about one of the tactics, I think, and maybe we'll get to this a little later, but I like to jump around in this podcast quite a bit. One of the things I kind of find useful in terms of motivating and making sure people are motivated or gauging that motivation is very physical cues. And there are very physical cues, at least when you're doing a face-to-face class.
But it doesn't work in an online class.
So, yeah, what are the replacements for the online class? I mean, for a face-to-face class, you're looking for that eye contact, and you can even force eye contact to make sure that people are engaged and people are motivated. But, yeah, what do you do with the online world?
I can tell somebody's motivated if they're getting their assignments in on time, if they seem eager in the discussions, or with the discussions, I require a minimal amount of participation, but I can tell they're really motivated if they're doing more than I require. I can tell they're not motivated if they're not getting things in on time, rather than doing the bare minimum.
Sure. When I was a graduate student and doing most of my work in a distance context, I feel like I could always gauge the kind of motivation and engagement of my peers by kind of how much they chatted into the chat and sort of how quick and how eager and like, oh, I've got this great resource, or you know, I feel like that was kind of one way to assess motivation or at least engagement.
So what's the
context.
Difference? Engagement
yeah.
and motivation, do we need to make a difference between the two? I guess I have in my head, but I wonder if you guys have as well.
They feel different to me.
Engagement might show motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, if you have a requirement in your class that students engage in a certain way.
Then it's just doing something.
Right, it's just, okay, I've got to do this. In order to get my grade, my extra.
But there's a bare
motivation.
Minimum there, too, compared to really being motivated to engage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when we talk about, when we think about motivation kind of as a topic in education, are we really more concerned with engaging the student in doing things, making sure they're getting their assignments in on time and doing them to the degree we expect them to do them, or do we really, really hope that by doing these assignments and keeping them engaged, that they're going to be attaining that level of intrinsic motivation that we really kind of hope for the future. Does that make sense? Like, is that a difference between engagement and motivation?
I don't know. These are tricky things. I feel like engagement is something, you know, I think in sort of our notes, Alan, you'd sort of talked about engagement as maybe like a short-term enticement, or maybe, you know, being really enthusiastic in my library instruction sessions maybe would help keep a student engaged. Does that mean that they're motivated to go on to become a professional librarian? Not necessarily. Does it mean
they're
motivated?
Care, yeah.
Does it mean that they're more motivated in their life to maybe stretch themselves in the resources that they use and the searching that they do? I don't know. I think that they're somehow distinct.
Fair enough. I think it's fair to keep them distinct at least a little bit, but
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's different levels of motivation and engagement, too.
Oh, do tell.
Go on.
I'm happy if they're motivated to complete my course and to do what they need to do, you know, to survive my class. But then to take it a step further, like you were saying, to actually use that beyond my class or to want to take more classes or, you know, to dig even deeper, goes even beyond. So mm-hmm.
That lifelong learner
right.
aspect of being a student or being a lifelong learner.
So being motivated really extrinsically to get that A or to pass the class is different than being intrinsically motivated and really wanting to do more.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we've been throwing around these terms, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, and just to sort of clarify, and my understanding, Jennifer, please, and Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, intrinsic motivation is that sort of comes within, you know, from within, like, wow, I'm really interested in the subject, so I'm really motivated to pursue it, and the rewards are internal. Like, I feel good when I've mastered the, I don't know, playing the guitar or whatever skill we want to talk about, versus the extrinsic, which are things like the candy, the grade, something that society, the piece of paper at the end of college, and external motivations. Does that sound pretty accurate? Because
yep.
I think it's really important to talk and think about the difference between the two. I'm looking here at a piece of research that I found, and it's called Motivating the Underprepared, Unmotivated Community College Student, and it's by Diana Kelly, and she's a researcher that comes out of California, wrote a lot about community college life. And she has a quote here, and I hope you guys will bear with me as I read it, right?
Oh,
remember,
please.
I'm a librarian. And I liked how she characterized lack of students who lack motivation. She says, college students who lack motivation may be characterized as those who are interested in the advantages of having a college degree, such as better job and opportunities, and the likelihood of making more money, rather than the learning that takes place in the process of obtaining the college degree. So I liked how she characterized, because I remember when I went to college, you know, I was sort of like, well, going to college because I need to and got to get that good job and the better money someday. But when I came out of college, sort of being like, oh, lots of interesting things happened to me, and I was shaped in ways I didn't necessarily know I would be shaped, and that somehow made me more motivated to do more education. So I just thought it was sort of interesting, this kind of putting yourself through the extrinsic paces can bolster your intrinsic motivation. I'm getting some blank
sometimes,
looks.
Sometimes, but not always.
right, not always. I mean, you know, maybe I was a happy coincidence that kind of happened.
So what are the steps that make it less likely to happen, maybe?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Yeah. If we don't know that. We can't even fathom the idea. But what...
Well, actually, Alan, I do have something.
Okay, good.
And this is kind of drawing on some of the research that... We looked at some YouTube videos from Daniel Pink, who wrote a book called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And he talks a lot about the three conditions that help people to be motivated. And his paradigm, again, correct me if I'm misquoting here, was it's important for people to have autonomy, to be able to master something, and to have purpose. So that frame of... As instructors, can we create conditions that encourage autonomy, encourage mastery, and encourage students to have authentic purpose?
And I think the answer would obviously be yes. We can certainly create certain environments, right, even in the online classes, to make sure that they they do have that ability to express their individuality and, what were the other ones, mastery.
Autonomy, mastery, right. And purpose.
And purpose. And purpose, obviously, is a big one. I think that maybe that one, in my mind anyway, kind of comes the easiest in terms of just explaining to students what it is that needs to be done for why they're going about doing this activity.
The relevance, right?
Mm, okay. The department's SMART goal for the year. For those of you in distance learning, we are, that is our SMART goal, relevance, right? Communicating the relevance, making sure that the people, the students, understand why it is they're doing what they're doing at any given time.
Yeah, that can be done in any class.
Any class. Hmm. Any moment of any class, I would imagine.
So aside from telling students why it's relevant, are there other ways to talk about purpose in a class?
I think the way that the assignments are designed can help students find the purpose. In my Intro to Social class, for example, I have students do learning journals where I ask them to apply concepts that they read about to their own lives.
And oh, absolutely.
By making it personal to them, that gives it purpose and meaning to them, makes it relevant to them, and they can start to see, oh, okay, well, maybe there is more to this than what was just in the textbook. Maybe this is meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that students need coaching through that kind of reflection, or are they pretty apt to
They're pretty good at that. The next step in the learning journal has them apply a theory, and that they need some help with. Okay. But actually applying it to themselves, they usually don't have a whole lot of problem with.
Cool. Sometimes I worry about when I communicate purpose to students, I kind of scan the room and you see a lot of eye rolls and you're like, well, yeah, okay, whatever. Kind of this purpose, this is the purpose of this thing? Sure. Do you get that as well, or is it just me that I'm not communicating it well enough?
Well, if it's coming from you, it's different than if it's coming from them too, though.
Right.
That's why I think it's cool when you can design something that allows them to find the purpose rather than you telling them what the purpose is.
I like that.
I like that too. How about autonomy? Like, how would you design a course or an assignment to encourage autonomy within your students? If we trust Daniel Pink's research, seems like it's pretty good stuff. And if autonomy is really important, any thoughts on how you would encourage autonomy? One thing I see with many composition instructors is you get to write a paper on a topic of your choice. It seems a pretty traditional way to encourage some level of autonomy.
Which is linked to what I just mentioned, too, being able to pick which concepts you found most relevant to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Going with it. Choices with assignments.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, like pick two out of three activities.
Yeah.
Maybe that would lead to some of that.
In developmental psych class, they can either do a research report or a child observation report. So they can go the direction they want to go if it's applied or research-based.
Oh, sure. Different branches within the discipline.
Yeah, and I think there's some playing with the idea of kind of self-paced courses, more self-paced. There's some here at the college, I think, who are playing with that idea, and it's a challenge, obviously, especially when you consider all the record-keeping and things, but I think... It does allow students to kind of make choices about when and how much time they need to accomplish certain activities. So that, I think, gets to that a little bit of making it feel like it's their own, giving them a little sense of ownership to the class.
That's great, except that some are motivated by due dates, too.
Right.
As professionals, of course, we're all motivated by due dates sometimes as well.
Yeah.
That makes me think of some of the learning initiatives that are happening a little bit outside of traditional academies, like the Khan Academy, where people can go in and choose to learn about, you know, he's got lots started with basic math and basic science. There's also Mozilla, which is the nonprofit that does the Firefox browser. They have these learning badges, so if you're a blogger or have a big social media presence, you can put a little badge on your blog saying, like, I learned about HTML5 coding. Just, you know, in that sort of lifelong, self-motivated learner space, that there would be autonomy, just like as professionals, we'd have autonomy in our professional development. But the thing I like about those badges, too, I know this might be a bit of a digression, is it's kind of allowing people to demonstrate mastery, too. Like, does it look cool within your online personal learning network if you can say, hey, I've mastered whatever coding thing or whatever other kind of badge you could have. I think that's just an interesting, are you motivated then? Is that a way to give yourself an extrinsic motivation? I don't know, just kind of a interesting newfangled thing out there that I think is interesting when it comes to motivation.
And I think that it extends even to discussion boards, which is maybe a feature on the Angel discussion board that we don't really have that could be there in a future version of it. But when you're on discussion boards, a lot of times on the web, you get different levels of participation. So you might be a newbie on the board, and so you get a different kind of icon going with that. But as you progress, as you post more, as you get more popular, as people like your posts, then you kind of move up the ranks, mm-hmm. and you get some recognition that way.
Oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was like a rate my post in your discussion?
There's the stars.
Now there are stars.
Oh, there are.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not an angel enough to know these things.
So. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Although the stars, I mean, there's a rating system, but I mean, in terms of rates, you never know who's doing the rating and why they're doing that rating.
And it's not a cumulative thing like you were talking about. It's
right.
Just for this one post.
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody could really give you a low rating when you didn't deserve it. You wouldn't know why.
Right. I guess.
So there's that. But yeah.
It can certainly go both ways.
Yeah. Indeed.
Let's see here. So, Alan, in some of your research, just because maybe moving into some of the other people who are writing about motivation, anyone jump out at you doing some interesting work there, aside from Daniel Pink?
Well, yeah. I guess there's two blogs that I kind of keep up with on a semi-regular basis as I read the web. One is this guy. He's an instructor, a teacher. I think he does elementary and grade school, maybe even high school level. His name is Larry Lazo, I don't really know how he says it, but he has a blog called Website of the Day. It's on EduBlogs. We'll link to it. But he's written a book about helping students motivate themselves. And his impression, and he talks about this at some length, that it's really not about how instructors can motivate students. It's about how instructors can create conditions in which students will motivate themselves. Just to quote the title. So he would be of the impression that we can't really motivate students. It's kind of the horse to the water thing. You can't really motivate them, but you can certainly create
opportunities
and environments where they could, if they chose to do so, they could be motivated. So it's kind of like you were saying about your own experience in being a student and then later kind of realizing all the great things that you did as a student and then taking that to the next level and continuing on with your education. So he would be very much in love with that, I think. Another writer is Jeremy Dean. He does the SciBlog. He's out of the UK, but he's got a lot of... he's more of a psychological studies guy, doing a lot of research on psychology and then blogging about the different research that's coming out. And so he's got a whole series on hacking goals, I think is how he's put it, and how we can get in, make sure we're not making the kind of common mistakes with that a lot of people make when we're setting goals and trying to motivate ourselves to achieve those goals. And that kind of raises another question that I had. Are there myths, what are the myths out there that people have about motivation and how do we set them straight? Do you know of any?
Well, I'll jump in and talk about the Daniel Pink and his TED Talk and his RSA Animate video. Seems to suggest from the research that traditional incentives to motivate people, things like money and rewards, work really well for like rote tasks, things like, I don't know, stuffing Netflix CDs into envelopes to mail out. You know, something like that, like more money, okay, yeah, I'm gonna do this rote task faster. But that when we're asking people to do creative, generative thinking, again, guys, correct me if I get my memory wrong here, that those incentives, as long as they're adequate, as long as people are being paid, you know, essentially a living wage, kind of the more they're ramped up, sometimes the more deleterious the reward. So asking people to do the, what is it, the nailing the candle to the wall mm-hmm. Activity, which really requires you to think outside the box a little bit when researchers ramp up
the literally outside the box.
outside the box. Ha ha, so funny. It becomes harder for them to think. So I just kind of wonder, you know, because I always sort of think, well, pile on more incentives and people will do a better job. But given that we live in such a knowledge economy, people have to do so much creative thinking in their jobs. Is it a myth to think, you know, more grades, more rewards equals better thinking? I think Daniel Pink suggests so. So I don't know if anyone has any thoughts.
And then how does that translate to the education world, where we're not actually paying students, although some experiments have been done, I understand.
Grades are payment.
Grades, yes. Yeah. Grades are a form of payment, but there's actually been those studies where they go into high schools and actually divvy out cash mm-hmm. for good grades. And it's my understanding that at least the studies seem to indicate that this doesn't work at all.
Right.
But okay, so grades are payment. So, but we can't really give them more A's for one class.
Points.
So we give them points. So points in here would be the same as saying money.
Right.
It's an extrinsic reward.
Mm-hmm. And so are we lumping on points for things that actually cause students not to do work? If we just give them more points, are they actually getting more discouraged then?
I don't know. I'm so intrigued by the fact that, you know, the studies indicate more reward doesn't mean more learning. I don't know, Jennifer, do you have any thoughts on?
I just think about going in and saying, okay, I'm not going to give you any points for doing this, and I'm pretty sure nobody's going to put too much effort into it.
Right.
So there has to be some extrinsic along with.
Well, one of the other things that Daniel Pink says is that one of the things you got to do in order to have motivated workers, and he really does focus more on business and workers than he is talking about education, but one of the things he says is you have to compensate people enough in order to take that off the table. You have to pay them enough in order so that money is no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way that we can give students enough points so it's
so
no longer an issue?
Points aren't an issue when it's just about the learning?
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's
I think more questions being raised
than answers are given.
Than we're able to answer.
Well, that's good.
You know, this, again, we'll post to the blog afterwards the resources that we keep mentioning, but this paper by Diana Kelly about motivating underprepared and unmotivated community college students does have some interesting ways, or just some interesting discussion about how can we sort of address motivation beyond the extrinsic. I don't know that I can really sum up what they are very cleanly, but I'd be happy to post it afterwards for those who are interested in this sticky wicket of motivation that we're thinking about. I'm talking about. Alan, did you have any other myths about motivation that?
Well, a couple that Jeremy Dean has pointed out on his blog. One is that most of these kind of come from motivational speakers. Do you like motivational speakers? Are you
not
a fan of them?
Much.
Not so much. Okay. Any reason why?
They're not overly motivational.
Right.
Yeah, isn't that weird how that works out?
It's kind of funny, isn't it? What are they doing wrong? One of the things that he says is that a lot of their goings on are centered on achieving and visualizing your success. And according to studies, a lot of what he's gone through the different research in psychology, and he says, well, you know, the things that they're saying to do don't really work for people. When you visualize success, a lot of times what you're doing is fantasizing about that goal and already having it achieved. And so that actually gets in the way of you taking the steps to make that you would need to make to actually attain that goal.
Hmm.
So better, he says, rather than visualizing your success is to visualize failure or visualize the steps that need to be taken in order to achieve that goal.
Hmm.
So that's just one of the other ones. The other one that he kind of points out is along the same lines is how we have a tendency as people, I think, to share our goals with each other. Things like, hey, I'm going on a diet. Can you please support me? Hey, I'm I need to exercise more, those kind of things. You tell people about it. I'm trying to quit smoking. And just in the telling of it, again, according to the research that he's referencing, it's somewhat lessens the motivation, the intrinsic motivators, that, and then you kind of just you run into problems, and you'll fall off the wagon, and you'll be okay with it. Because I guess just telling people about it kind of feels like I've done something. I've accomplished something. Yeah. Have you had that experience?
I can see it going the other way somewhat too, that, okay, I've announced to everyone that I'm going to lose weight or that I'm going to exercise, so I better do it.
Right. You know? Yeah, they're going to hold me accountable.
Right.
If only they would hold you accountable, right?
Maybe that's really the key there, that you need to make sure that somebody's on your back making sure you get it done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, that's, you know, it's another extrinsic motivation, sort of like shame or like fear of losing face. Like, oh gosh, you know, as Alan and I were just talking a little bit about preparing for this podcast, Alan and I were just asking each other, you know, kind of what motivates you, just as a general human being. And for me lately, you know, I said fear.
Fear's a huge motivator.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that I necessarily want to be motivated by fear, but it just kind of is, you know, I'm the mother of a young son, and so lately a lot of things I'm like, oh, what about these things happening in the future? And I feel very motivated to do a lot of things out of fear. I don't know, were there other things?
Well, I guess that raises a question in my mind. Is it okay to be motivated by these sort of what we might conceive of being negative structures of our culture, our society, or is it better somehow to be motivated by more positive attitudes?
It might be better, but it's basic human nature to be motivated by things like fear.
Well, and when we were talking,
it'd be nice if you could focus on the positive. But
well, I think can't you? I just choose to focus on the positive. I mean, when we were talking about it, fear really comes down to, for me anyway, fighting or running away.
Run away,
and I tend to run away. I think is what I would do. And then as soon as you're away, then you can focus on more positive things about the sun is shining and it's nice outside and isn't this a good day to garden.
Maybe more importantly than even asking, is it bad to be motivated by, you know, fear? Fear is bad. I have another book in front of me, and this is called Enhancing Adult Motivation to Learn, A Comprehensive Guide for Teaching All Adults. And I was just looking through it, and there's an instructor self-assessment regarding motivation. And it's just sort of a little one-page, three questions kind of assessment, because the book talks about how do you assess if your learners are motivated, but also what motivates us as instructors, that assessing that and understanding your motivation might be kind of key to helping you understand your students' motivation. So there's just three questions in this book, and it's, you know, assessing what's your perception of your role as the instructor. You know, there's always the sage on the stage versus guide on the side, and, you know, obviously lots of areas in between there. What are your assumptions about the motivations of the adults that you're teaching or training? Do you assume, oh, I'm teaching a bunch of adults who are here because they have to be here, they're compelled to be here, they don't necessarily want to be here, or other? And then what are your perceptions of your instructional situation? And this includes things like the organization you work for. So I just thought it was interesting that Alan and I had talked a little bit about what motivates us personally, and then this book also says it's, you know, it's important to understand your own motivations too, that might influence your students. So another thing we'll post on the blog afterwards for instructors out there listening who might want to know more about enhancing adult motivation to learn.
Well, I think that's a great way to reflect on how you personally think about motivation, because those thoughts are certainly being modeled for the students in the room, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And we all probably go into the classroom with an idea of how motivated our students are, too. But
right.
It can become a self-fulfilling prophecy on their part.
Yeah. Prophecies. One further thought on fear. I guess part of what would scare me about fear is then the short term of it. It seems very quick. You're afraid of something, you have to resolve that fear very, very quickly.
Reaction based.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's short sighted of me as well. Maybe there is long term fear as well. There's phobias.
There's a deep seated fear.
There can be.
talking about raising a child, like that's an 18 year fear or beyond, you know?
Sure.
Things that you could do wrong or that could possibly go wrong.
And fear of failure is a big one that a lot of people share, I think. Fear of public speaking. And these are things that people come into the classroom with and probably have to struggle with as students.
Fear of looking stupid. Fear of, mm-hmm. I can only, especially in our community college context, our non-traditional students. I mean, can you imagine how difficult it could be if you're afraid of looking stupid in front of a bunch of 18-year-olds? You haven't been in the classroom for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that fear could be motivating to disengage.
Indeed.
Well, we had sort of said we would move on now to maybe thinking a little bit about practical suggestions to help students, help engender student motivation or to engage students. And I would just invite, there's a handful of people who are here with us live. Keith, Carol, Aaron, if you've got any ideas about student engagement or creating spaces that encourage motivation, I'll just invite you to please submit them on the chat. I don't have it in front of me, but Alan will let me know, sure, if it pops up. So I sort of had a thought and a kind of maybe story to share with you guys. I was on the reference desk and working with a student who was in a comp class and writing a research paper, and essentially in her interaction with me, it sort of came up. She just really had no idea how to write a research paper. You know, she'd really been reading the textbook and really, I think, was understanding the higher level concepts, but just the actual doing of writing the research paper was a challenge for her. And she knew her goal was to get to the end, to have a well-written argument and the rhetorical stuff, but she didn't know what next action steps to take. So we went through, okay, we're going to find some good articles to read. We're going to read them. As we're reading, we're going to, I always use different colored highlighters. We're going to use different colored highlighters for things that really catch your attention or something you might want to quote in your paper. And as Alan was talking a little bit earlier about envisioning like these big goals, like I want to be 30 pounds slimmer or whatever, versus taking the next action step, how motivating it felt to that student. And it seemed like she was feeling much better because she knew just these little tiny action steps to take. And I know one thing that can be helpful in instructional design is scaffolding learning. Mm-hmm. So when we have big, complicated topics and subjects, ways we can scaffold the learning can be motivating and help increase that mastery, right? If we're going by Daniel Pink's, we want to encourage autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So that's one real tactical, sort of an abstract way to get there maybe, but a real tactical thing we can do to help students be motivated and be successful in our courses is to be real tactical and think about what are the next actual physical steps you're going to take to get this assignment done and to move through this learning. So that was kind of one practical tip that I had.
And that would be kind of in contrast to a paper that was left a little bit more open-ended, maybe? Or, I mean, I guess there's that kind of style of activity as well, where you want the students to explore and really kind of come up with their own agendas and their own structure of things. But maybe that would be detrimental to their motivation if they get stuck.
True. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question.
Scaffold to the point where you can let them fly on their own.
Is that somebody's quote? Did you just make that up? It's good. I'm writing that down.
We'll quote you on it in the future.
There you go.
A future podcast.
Dr. Jen says.
Any other thoughts? Like, what do you guys do to motivate your students?
I really like the personal relevance. Like I said before, try to show them how the class is meaningful and useful to them.
Okay.
And a lot of times I can't do that for them. That's something I need to provide the opportunities for them to do that themselves.
Hmm. One thing I've done, I guess this kind of speaks to mastery a little bit. or at least it should in theory, is really allow them to become the teacher.
Okay.
Set up the assignment so that, and break it up so that they're in charge of the discussion for a week or for a day.
It's actually the best way to learn. Teaching other people is the best way to learn.
And I've heard that. Yes. Yeah. So you want them to obviously get deep into that that whatever topic it is, so you have them choose their topic, at least that's the way I've done it before, you know, have them choose their topic and then really come up with their own discussion questions and then engage their peers in that discussion. And that has worked out okay in the past. Some of them really take to it, others really kind of do flounder, I think, because there isn't that scaffolding for them. All the time, there may have been a text, there may have been some ideas, but they probably would have needed more guidance to really come up with a great discussion. But that's challenging for anybody. I mean, leading a discussion is challenging.
Mm-hmm. So I think fear comes into that too. I did something similar with my social problems class years ago when I had them try to lead debates in class. And some students just wouldn't show up on their debate days.
Nice.
Oh, and I have a feeling fear probably played a motivating part of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some people, I actually got some people saying they didn't feel like it was their job to
teach. Yeah, you're the teacher. You should be structuring this.
Right, exactly. So there's obviously a disconnect on what it means to learn and what it means to teach, what it means to be engaged as a student and what it means to be a student. And yeah, so that's a good chance for a conversation, obviously, to around these things, but.
In my Enhancing Adult Motivation book, it sort of talks about some actual kind of tactics or strategies. So I'll just kind of throw these out there, and Alan or Jennifer, if something grabs you.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Stop me. So one thing that the book talks about, and some of these strategies are really tied to creating a positive attitude towards the instructor and towards the subject. And so some of the strategies, you know, real things we can do in courses, talks about, I'm going to just start listing them, allowing for introductions. So allowing for students in your class to kind of come to know each other, because it can be more motivating, especially in group work.
Mm-hmm. That sense of community.
Yep, yeah. To know people. And then there's that chance for holding each other accountable, which can certainly be motivating. Concretely indicating your intentions to help your adult learners learn. So saying, you know, I'm here to help you. That's a strategy. Sharing something of value with your adult learners. Not sure what they mean by this. It doesn't explain, but maybe the text would tell us more. When issuing mandatory assignments or training requirements, give your rationale for these stipulations. This is one thing in the library we see a lot with citations. And I think when I explain to students that citations are there as a way to help kind of give credit, share credit, that it's really about a kind of community of scholarship, sometimes they're like, oh, okay, well, I still don't necessarily like doing them, but I understand they're not just something to do for no good reason. The next one on the list here is, to the degree that's authentically possible, reflect the language, perspective, and attitudes of adult learners. I thought this was sort of an interesting one. I don't know if you guys... Well, we'll just toss them out. Acknowledge that there's different ways of knowing, different languages, different levels of knowledge or skill to create a safe environment. Minimizing negative conditions that surround the subject. So just some interesting actual tactics for anyone who's interested in how can we motivate, enhance adult motivation to learn. So one resource we'll put out there on the blog and we have in the Kirkwood Library.
So another one that I guess I had was that maybe it's part of that same list, but it's it kind of comes from the Mindset book, Carol Dweck, and how there's a need to, or at least I think this comes from that book, where we want to kind of focus more on the effort and the outcome, rather than really praising the intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so when students do good work, obviously you want to acknowledge that good work. But by acknowledging the work, you want to be little bit careful on that and point more towards the effort that they put into that work and not so much how smart they are, how they always do good work and you expect this from them, or I don't know.
So saying something like, "Alan, that was a great podcast you did," instead of, "You're a great person. You're just great all around," you know, focusing. I think, you know, with children too, you want to say that was a bad thing that you did.
Not that you're a bad kid.
Exactly. So maybe that's...
Similar aspects there, I think, going on. Another question I guess I had for you, Jen, was about games. And because I know
my game project.
Because I know you did a great game project. And I know there's a lot of game theory, gamification in education now. A lot of people are talking about that. How do we get the concepts that are so engaging with games into the classroom?
And maybe as a way to start that, could you tell me about your game project?
It's a little different than gaming. Trying to get my students to apply what they're learning. In developmental psych, I had them develop educational games and then find research to support how they developed the games the way they did. Okay. So trying to make a research project a little more fun. And they still had to do the find the articles, report on them, describe the research methods used and all that. But then they had to take it a step further to describe how that could be applied to the development of a game. And then they actually had to develop the game when we played them in class.
How fun.
I thought so. Some were overly motivated, though.
Oh. Overly motivated. And
to create wonderful games? Or
yes. Well, why can't I just do a basic research project instead of having to make a game, too?
Interesting. I was talking a little bit with some of my librarian colleagues, because many of my colleagues are very into games. And librarians love games, and many libraries have them. And just in some reading I did about it, it talked about how a good game really is able to tap into cooperation, competition, immersion, and or achievement, and how that, you know, these are motivators. You know, I'm either motivated to compete or to cooperate. You know, I love Trivial Pursuit. And there's nothing more fun than my sisters and I being on a team. And, like, we're so motivated to beat my parents. You know, we're going to cooperate in order to compete them. And it's funny. I mean, there's no better name for a game than Trivial Pursuit, right? Because it really doesn't matter getting my little colored pieces in my pie. But I'm so motivated when it comes to that game. So I think there's something to study from games there. You know, how do you do that?
When we talk about biological psychology, it's not real exciting to talk about the structure of a neuron and neurotransmitters and all that. But when we play neurotransmitter bingo in class, all of a sudden everybody gets a little bit more excited and they're looking through their books to find the answers and make a game out of it. And suddenly it's not so blah.
Yeah. Play is important.
And play is part of it, and I think as instructors, I think feedback is part of it. Mm. I think, just the parallels between games and what we do as teachers, I think games really do give you that immediate feedback as you're going through the game. You're getting answers to questions in Trivial Pursuit. You're building up your wedges. You're getting points, I guess, in more digital areas.
Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Right. There's a lot of feedback, and I think that's kind of similar. I mean, if I think that's kind of where people start trying to add game-like elements into a class. They often will start with how do I give that immediate feedback score type thing, scoreboards into my class. How can I do that in order to get students to achieve certain goals. So are you still doing the game project?
I'm not doing the game project anymore because of some group dynamics issues. But I'm still doing neurotransmitter bingo.
Oh, okay. So. Still having some fun. That's good.
That is a fabulous thing.
Well, we're almost out of time here for the day, for the podcast. So any last-minute thoughts I'd invite from guests and hosts?
You know, my final thought is I've been very motivated to learn about motivation, in part because of the deadline of this podcast. But I found it a very rich and interesting field. And even just watching, you know, at just the, what was it, 15-minute TED Talk that Daniel Pink has, or the RSA Animate, really brought up a lot of questions for me around motivation in education. And I'd love to continue that conversation with colleagues from across the web and here at Kirkwood. So I definitely invite that. Again, we'll post these resources, but I hope to see some of you in the library checking out some of our books and articles, if that's motivating for you. So that's all I've got.
How about you, Jen? Any last-minute thoughts? Dr. Jen is the foremost authority here at Kirkwood on motivation and engagement.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. Oh. But what you just said about if that's motivating for you, I think that's another important thing, is that different things motivate each of us. Mm-hmm. And a room full of students or a room full of virtual room in an online class, everybody's going to be motivated by something different. Hmm. And it's kind of a challenge to try to find what it is on an individual basis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thanks all for your time and attention to listening to the Education Is podcast. Next month, we'll be back talking about first-time instructor education with a new faculty member here at Kirkwood in the distance education math area. And that's it. I guess we're signing off the podcast here.
Thanks for coming, everybody.